Hello, and welcome to the 73 Seconds Podcast. This is the show for anyone committed to ending sexual violence, all about how to support survivors and eradicate violence. And on this episode, we talked with Isabella Nuno, the co-president of Latinos Unidos, and to write Love in Her Arms at Lake Forest College. Listen in as we talk about goals that Isabella has for these groups, a conversation on machismo and Latinx culture and its impact, media representation surrounding machismo, as well as discussing mental health awareness and suicide prevention.
Let's see, where do we want to start? We have Isabella Nuno with us today. Do you want to do a quick introduction of who you are, where you're at in your life, and kind of what brought you here today?
Yeah, so I'm currently a senior at Lake Forest College. And I know this is going to become prominent, so I'm a co-president of Latinos Unidos, which is a cultural club, and co-president of To Write Love on Her Arms, which is a mental health chapter at my school. And I'm just kind of trying to struggle with the senior year currently and figure out what I would like to do going forward.
Nice. Pandemic life, right?
Yes, that as well.
Are your classes online or?
They are in person.
Okay, so not too bad, not terrible. Where are you from?
Yeah, so I'm from the city of Chicago. I'm actually from near Midway, so near that area, so not too far.
Nice, now you're up in Lake County. Mm-hmm. Bit of a change there.
Definitely, yes.
So what attracted you to Latinos Unidos and To Write Love in Her Arms on your campus?
So I have a whole story I tell when it comes to LU, so I call it LU, just to shorten it, because I remember being homesick, so I think it's also important for this conversation for me to say that I am a first-generation student as well, and I struggle with that a lot, especially the first, 2 weeks, just the first weeks right away, I struggle with that. And I distinctly remember showing up to LU and talking about being homesick and kind of how it felt for me to be away from family, also being the oldest sibling and just being away from my younger siblings and all of those mixed in emotions and just struggling with being a college student all of a sudden. And I remember that in the meeting, it was so accepting, and I had members as well as exec members after the meeting come to me, talk to me, give me their phone numbers. And it was just one of the most welcoming experiences I've ever had. Since that day forward, I have not stopped being part of LU. My second year, I became co-president and have done that since. So we really try to just create that welcoming space and kind of safe space for students who are Latina identifying, but also to just learn about the culture as well. And for To Write Love in Her Arms, that is an organization that has been near and dear to my heart since I was in high school. I did a presentation on them and a project in high school, and I've known about them for so long. And then knowing that there was a chapter at Lake Forest kind of is one of the reasons why I chose that school as well, knowing that I can get involved as soon as I stepped in the door. And that's what I did. I restarted the club my first semester and kind of have worked and struggled with that club. It is mental health, so it's not always the most popular club, which I know we'll get into, but that's kind of, mental health is really important to me, so I really wanted to create a conversation about that on campus as well.
I think what's most important about those two clubs, and what I'm hearing from you talk about them, is a sense of community, right? When you're away from home, you're on college campus for the first time, and you're feeling safe in this new community that's welcomed you, and people are, introducing themselves and bringing you into the mix. And To Write Love in Her Arms is kind of doing them the same sense of saying, you're not alone. We're all here to provide support for those who need it, who are struggling with mental health, right?
Yes, exactly.
I want to kind of talk about what struggles have you faced in trying to lead these organizations?
So I think one main struggle that is identifiable in both is we have a very strong presence of women identifying, people showing up, but not so much on male identifying people. So that is something that we struggle with a lot, and especially To Write Love in Her Arms. And we want to have those discussions of mental health specifically with men and how that feels and how it's not talked about as much. So that's something that we've been wanting to do, but it's just hard not having those members come to meetings and kind of be as involved. So we have a lot of ideas of how to deal with that this year. Kind of the same as present with LU as well. So we're just trying to kind of rectify that because we think there's a lot to talk about, which I know we'll get to machismo, but like that's something that we have started to talk a lot more about as well, and we kind of want all perspectives on that. Mm-hmm. So we're kind of struggling with that recently. Mm-hmm. And when it comes to Try Love in Your Arms, not everybody is very attracted to talking about mental health, so that's just been a general struggle.
Yeah.
And we're kind of also trying to deal with that and just do collabs and trying to bring it forefront so that people cannot ignore it.
Yeah, and you mentioned machismo, but we can dive right into that, right? We don't need to, like, wait. I think to start, do you want to kind of give our listeners, like, a little background into what machismo may be and what that role is in Latinx culture?
Yeah, of course. So when it comes to machismo, the way that I describe it, which may or may not be how other people think about it, is it's basically toxic masculinity, but ingrained in the kind of Latinx culture. So it feels different for different people within the culture, but I think it's basically just the equivalent of it for people that don't know what it is. It's kind of just toxic masculinity that, for me, is deeply ingrained. It's part of the culture, mm-hmm. Which is what can be hard to deal with it and to separate it at sometimes. But that's kind of how I think about it. And that's relevant for me in many different fields, including these two both clubs. I think when we talk about mental health, machismo is a huge barrier to even discussing mental health.
Yeah.
And I would like to talk later just about how mental health in the, you know, Latinx community is something that I strive to work on and kind of why I got involved in mental health in the first place.
Because
that's something that is just not talked about as much. Well, yeah, when it comes to machismo in general, we just had a big talk about this in LU in our last meeting. We got a lot of interesting and different perspectives from people, but it's honestly just this really big barrier in the culture that we are trying to deal with right now. It's definitely become a bigger topic of discussion recently, which is nice to see that.
No, I definitely agree. I think that's a good way of putting it. Machismo can be related to toxic masculinity, and I mean, probably see it portrayed in the media itself alone and how that is impacting our own communities, right?
Yeah, definitely. I think when we talk about also just sexual assault, sexual abuse, victim blaming, I think machismo plays a big role into all of that, and that is also why those discussions aren't always being had in different Latin communities as well, because of machismo. And also just the portrayal of having to be strong and not being able to talk about mental health and vulnerabilities is a huge barrier that we see. Even for people that don't prescribe to machismo as much as they see other people who think they are actively working on it, which they are, it still shows up in different aspects of life, which I think is really important to discuss it, that, you know, it's not this thing that we can eradicate out of nowhere. It's this thing that we constantly have to think about and be active about where these ideas are coming from and why they're showing up.
Yeah, I think with toxic masculinity, it's very similar to, like, conversations we have, I think, on anti-racism as well. Whereas, like, we can be working to be anti-racist and to, like always expanding our understanding of what it means to be anti-racist. And that, like, there's always something, like, a seedling that's deeper down that we may realize. And if once we find that, be like, oh, I need to think on, why do I have that thought? Where did that come from? I think it's the same with toxic masculinity, right? That we need to be talking about in our culture. It's not just this broad, like, that's toxic, but, you know, like, it's deeper down. It's got to be, where did that line of thinking come from? And I need to be focusing on that, right? And analyzing it, making sure that I am combating that thought.
Yeah, and I think you brought up a really good point about the way that sexual violence is prevented in Latina communities, because we know that sexual assault and sexual violence affect different communities differently. And that's one of the things that we're working at with the Z Center, is how do we teach sexual assault prevention in meeting communities where they're at? Because if you don't take into account machismo, you're missing out on a big conversation to be had around sexual assault prevention. And if you don't talk about queer identities to queer students, you're missing out on a huge thing that needs to be talked about with them, how sexual assault looks in different communities. And so I think that you bring up a really good point about meeting communities where they're at and really understanding cultures before you go into that community and say, hey, we want to help you.
Yeah.
If you're coming from a perspective that is the traditional perspective, which is very white female base, then you're going to be talking to the wall, essentially, because nobody's going to understand what you're saying.
Yeah, like, let me come in and give you all these tools, and the community you're coming into is like, that's not the tools that we need. That's not at all what we were talking about, right?
Yeah.
So I think you mentioned this a little bit earlier, too. What are some of the conversations that are happening in the Latino community about sexual assault or trauma in general?
Yeah, I think that, which has been also what we see generally with mental health, there's been a move to discuss these things a lot more than there has been in the past. I think each generation kind of says, hey, we need to talk about this. But it still needs to be worked at. I still don't see that conversation happening as often. Mm-hmm. And I know that this is something that we've seen recently with different cases going of women missing, but we don't talk about people of color missing. So I think that's like something that we've recently talked about on LU too, where we'd like to talk about this kind of, like you mentioned, the media representation. We are missing from a lot of that media. And when we are put in the media, it is very stereotypical and very negative.
Yeah.
And that we cannot accept that either. So I think there has to be a lot of work to be made within all of those sections when we think about it. But I think that those are conversations that we are not having as much, and we are just starting to have, but we need to have more. Also, when you think of the role of machismo in relationships, what is accepted, and gender stereotypes, those are things that are natural to so many people, but really are not, and need to be broken down, and how we can make these relationships slash just people feel better about themselves and their role in life as well.
Yeah, and we've kind of touched on some like broad topics of machismo and how the Latino culture is having conversations about sexual assault and trauma. Kind of bring it down and ask, what are some things you've done as co-president of LU to kind of, I want to say, like, combat these issues? And then what are some of the goals you have for the rest of your senior year in order to combat them?
Of course. So just recently we had a meeting about, it was a very general meeting, like, come with discussion topics. And we'll talk about whatever you want to talk about, because I think that's a good way to gauge what we should be doing, because we can't leave it all to exact to what I want to talk about. That's not the point of any of my clubs. So we did get a lot of feedback, and a lot of people actually talked about machismo. So we had a really in-depth discussion. Also, what it means to be a student of color going to school, and how some male-identifying students were told that they should work, and some non-male-identifying students were told that they should just go to school and focus on school and not focus on working, or et cetera. There was a lot of different messages being told to different people, and I think that is also very relevant, not only to machismo, not only to what these people are being told, but also to being a student of color in a predominantly white school, which is a lot of schools. So just even entering that higher education role, I think, is something that a lot of our students are thinking about. Especially we have newer students coming in and thinking about all the things that every new student thinks about when they're entering college. I think that's something that we're starting to have discussions about. And because there is such a big emphasis put on machismo, we actually want to do like an event with other cultural clubs and just talk about toxic masculinity and how it feels, how it looks in different cultures, and kind of have a panel discussion. And this is something that I think we're really pushing for either this semester or next semester. That is a big event that we want to have and kind of just face it front head, and then that'll go with Trey Love in Her Arms and talking about how those ideas affect mental health in all communities. So those are some of our big goals. I know for mental health too, October is Domestic Violence Awareness Month. So I'm hoping to team up with It's On Us on campus and to do some kind of event in October, because I think, again, I'm just trying to be more aware of topics like that and generally talking about that. Also talking about healthy relationships, because I think nobody is taught that until way, honestly, too late. I don't feel like I was taught that until it was too late, and I had already experienced an abusive relationship. And I think if I was taught about that sooner, I would have been able to catch a lot of signs a lot sooner than I was able to. So that's something that I think we're also trying to tackle within the semester slash year. There's a lot of ideas that we're trying to tackle, so I'm hoping we get to all of them.
I know, I was going to say, it's like a lot for such a short amount of time, and then also to like put on students' shoulders.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. So I guess that kind of leads into our next question of, how do you feel about your institutional support? Do you think that you're getting adequate institutional support from your college? What would, if not, what would adequate institutional support look like in your mind?
Yeah, I think that's a really important question. Also, just acknowledging the kind of school, the kind of wealth in the town. Mm-hmm. A lot of the things around this area that specifically like students of color is kind of like a shock. It's a culture shock for many students coming to a school like this. Mm. I think I've seen support increase in some areas and just not really exist in other areas. Mm-hmm. So I think when it comes to LU and cultural clubs, they're a little more prominent on campus because we've been there for so long. And I can't say if that's necessarily because of the institution or because of the work of the actual students.
Yeah.
But I do think that there is work to be had, especially when there is a whole office dedicated to that and their attention is very focused and not given to, I think, all of the other clubs that are on campus. So I think there needs to be more focus. I think there needs to be a greater attention to collaborations, not only between us and students, but also the school thinking about that.
Mm-hmm.
The connection between Tourette Love in Her Arms and Health and Wellness and Peer Wellness Educators is what they're called. I think those collabs are natural and should be pushed also by the school and by those offices. It shouldn't constantly be the students seeking those groups out. So I think we definitely can use more support in many different arenas. And that's something that we have been advocating for and are currently advocating for as well. So I hope to see that continue and get better. And I know that the school is, you know, recognizing that as well, that that is something that we need.
Yeah. And just for clarification, Isabella is talking about Lake Forest, Illinois, which has a median household income of about $170,000 a year. And was actually a sundown town for Black and Brown identifying people and Jewish identifying people until the early 90s.
Shut up. How did I not know it was a sundown town?
Yeah.
Lake Forest?
Yeah, it was a sundown town.
Until when?
The early 90s.
The early 90s?
It was so, like, obviously it was, like, de jure sundown town until the early 90s.
Yeah.
And it was, like, written, but nobody, like, really...
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Sorry, it was de facto. It was written, but nobody, like, really followed it. And then in, like, the early 90s, they were like, can't have that. It's, we had an archive of it, but the archive has actually disappeared.
Yeah, I do want to say that there's many issues in the town. One thing that I do remember is the town actually did reach out to Tourette Love in Her Arms to do an event about mental health in the community.
Town did?
Yes, yeah, that was... I forget exactly who, but that was something that happened in the town of Lake Forest. And that, I think, was a very super helpful event. We got to see it being discussed. We got to be there and be present. And I think that was the first time that I've seen or heard of anything like that. Mm-hmm. So those kind of collaborations are also nice. But there is a huge gap of seeing in that town, walking in that town versus where all these students are coming from. And I think that's a real issue that we are starting to also talk about and deal with and kind of just manage, because that can be hard and starking. One clear example for me is they have like the robots that cut the grass, and I just cannot get past that fact, because for me and people who visit me from the city and just friends that I have always see that, and they're like it's just, it's so confusing. And to even understand that that's a thing that is available and to see that, and then to also see workers only of color doing that work in those white towns, I think it's a lot as a student of color to kind of process and think about.
Yeah.
I'm thinking a lot of things.
Yeah.
I mean, on a good note, I'll start with that. It sounds like we were talking about support from an institution and, like, there's potential for it to get better, and it also sounds like there's potential for support from the community that you're in when it comes in regards to Tourette Love in Her Arms. But the other thought I'm having is the fact that Lake Forest is a sundown community up until the 90s, like, that thinking, whether that's, like, recorded in the archives or not now, that's still very much ingrained in the community there. So, like, you're making steps, but you're also fighting against something that is so ingrained in the creation of that town. Without, like, the acknowledging of the town saying that that's what it was.
Yeah.
And that is just...
And Lake Forest College is a PWI, predominantly white institution.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so there's a lot to be said about who is... I'm also a graduate of Lake Forest College, so I have a lot to say about institutional advocacy from all across all college campuses and the way that college campuses support students. But I'm thinking just in kind of our microcosm, you are really going up against a whole lot as a woman, as a person of color, as a student.
As a mental health advocate.
Yeah, you're really going through a lot.
There's a lot of intersectionality.
Yes.
And that's one of the things that we talk about a lot on our team is, like, what is that intersectionality? How do we, as a team, understand that what we're fighting for, which is, like, ending sexual violence, how does everybody's identity and, like, the various aspects of a person's identity affect the way that sexual violence is harming them or is perpetuated against them? So I think the idea of, like, institutional advocacy is very fascinating because it's a hard thing to push against, especially when your college was founded in
1857.
And has been run the same way for a very, very long time. So,
I will say that there's a lot to work on. I've heard a lot of discussions, though. There's a lot of students. I mean, we've seen this all my years, that there are students who will just not back down and talk, have those hard conversations with the institution. There's also talks of it becoming a Hispanic-serving institution, so that's kind of lingering in the air, something that they've been thinking about for years, and we're kind of just, like, waiting and seeing if that will even be implemented correctly.
Can you define what you mean by a Hispanic-serving institution?
Generally. Yeah. So from what I know, it's a school receives a lot of, like, federal money, and that is supposed to specifically be used for Hispanic-identifying students, so it's to support those students of color specifically. And that's just money that the school gets in order to do that. So that's the scope of what I know of it. I'm sure there's more to say about it, but that's just what I know. And I know that there are students who are really pushing right now for that to be something within the next year or so to occur. But that is something that we're just sitting and waiting.
What has been your journey in embracing your Latinx identity? And what has that meant specifically within this hyper-masculine, like, American pull-up-your-own-bootstraps mentality?
That's a loaded question. Very
important. Take your time.
I will say that is something that I think has always been a struggle, but it was very in my face as a college student, because I think that's just your first year. You're not only learning how to be a college student, but you're also learning about yourself and what you want to be involved in. So I think it was natural that that was so prominent in my life at that time. But I think that these are conversations that I have with my friends all the time.
Yeah.
Just being in these two cultures and wanting to disregard whole parts of both and also wanting to mesh, but also not wanting to lose what it means to have a culture. I will also say this, mention that I am also second generation Mexican American, if you will. So I feel like there's a difference also between generations. So I feel even more disconnected from my parents' culture and just from that, Latina identity, because my parents were born here and I've been here longer. And so there's certain even holidays or things that my parents don't celebrate. So some things that I didn't really connect with until I joined LU, and those were things that we did there. So I feel that in some parts I've embraced a little bit more of, you know, my Latina identity and using it kind of to fuel me to make these changes and to say that you cannot ignore me and that I am here. And when it comes to being that, like, dual, existing also in the American identity as well, and how I think those conflict so often, but also in a gross way they align when it comes to specifically that masculinity, and just growing up and seeing parts of my family, specifically men in my family, struggling with their machismo / masculinity so much so that it's been the detriment to some, because they cannot express those mental health concerns and they struggle with that severely. And just seeing how that shows up in also relationships in my family, and seeing all of those bad examples, if you will, of things that I know that I don't want in my life, is something that I've struggled with too. But then I also don't want to discount either parts of my identity, because they all are part of me. And I think, you know, even though me and my friends will gladly shit talk the American dream, because honestly, it's a myth.
Yes.
So we will discuss that. But I think in a weird way, there is, you know, there's some hope there of knowing that we have the freedom to choose which parts of our identities we want to highlight and which parts we really don't want to continue, especially when you think of future generations and not even just, you know, like my sisters or in whatever form that may be for you. And also, I think something that has kind of been lingering in my head but hasn't been said is that intergenerational trauma that gets passed on and passed on. And I've even read studies of how, like, psychologically in your brain, how that presents in other generations. And that is just, like, beyond me. The psych major in me is just, like, geeking out about that. But, like, I think it's so tremendous to think about how that intergenerational trauma stays and sticks with you even when you can't even truly identify where that's coming from, but you know that it's there. I think that's also something that we've been struggling with, especially when it comes to being, you know, identifying as a Latina and being told a whole bunch of mixed messages just within my family, but also in the media of what it should be and what's proper and et cetera, right? And you know, struggling with all of that and knowing that I don't want to continue that, continue those kind of ideas forward, and I want to address those and stop those. And again, me and my friends have many conversations about that. And also just being a survivor as well, I think, has been a really big struggle with hearing all these messages, not only in the media, especially in American culture, but also, you know, in the Latina culture and ideas about relationships and victim blaming, I think, is a huge thing in both identities and cultures, and I think that that is horrendous and very difficult to struggle on a normal level, but especially when you're a survivor, too, listening to the both of cultures that you identify with, struggling to even accept a big part of your life or something that you went through, I think can be really damaging, and that's something that I probably will continue to struggle with forever, but just something that I've also been thinking a lot. So I know it's definitely, I don't even know if I got to anything specific or it's just all been general.
No, I think it was perfect, right? And I think I want to thank you, right, for sharing that you are also a survivor, in addition to all the other things we're talking about today, all the other parts of your identity. But I think you said a lot of really good stuff in there, especially, like, this intergenerational trauma. Like you said, you're second generation, right? So this intergenerational thing, from my studies, right, it's intergenerational trauma expands through 8 generations. So something happens, then 8 generations from you, they'll still feel the impact of that trauma, right? And so second gen, like, you're feeling all of that and more, and then also throwing into the discourse around Latino people in America right now, right, the added, like, just so much, like, trauma and stress and pressure. God, there was something else in there that you said that I was like, I want to touch on that too.
Well, you kind of reminded me. I will say that within working in admissions, I read many things from many different students, and something generally, some pattern that I've seen of a lot of students who started to apply to college recently have been just words from, I, like, don't even want to say his name, but I feel like it's important to mention, but just words that have come from Trump. And hearing students of color, specifically, you know, Latina identifying students, struggle so much with what it means to be in this culture, to want to be themselves, and also just, like, not feeling secure in that. And we can also talk about DACA students and so many other students who are on our campus and in all of our communities struggling with just making it day by day and just wanting to go to school and wanting to get an education and struggling with that and all these mixed messages of who they should be and who they are when none of that is, a lot of it isn't true. I think it's something that I've seen come up a lot, and it's been hard to have these discussions of what it actually means to have to call, to kind of, like, mesh, to be somebody who has a mesh culture, if you will, when a big person in, you know, in the United States is saying all of these bad things about you and about your ancestors. Because I can talk about myself here, but I also think heavily about my ancestors and what they went through just to be here, just to be in this country, but also just to survive, I think, is a huge and prominent thing in a lot of people's heads right now.
Yeah, I think it's that duality, right, mm-hmm. of I'm American, but I'm also Mexican-American. Mm-hmm. So where does that leave me? Mm-hmm. When I want to embrace my heritage and my culture, but the other side of my culture, this American side, is telling me that's wrong.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right? I think when I talk to a lot of people, but also just for myself, like, I feel like I'm neither or, mm-hmm. but also, like, some kind of in-between. And I think another thing for students is if you talk about language, right, and mm-hmm. Spanish culture, mm-hmm. the Spanish language means so ingrained into this culture, but at the same time, how, like, gendered the language is, and mm-hmm. that is something that students are also mm-hmm. tackling with, to, like, change the language, but also, like, what does it mean to even, like, speak Spanish? And there's all these other themes, right, yeah. that we can get into, but also just students who do speak Spanish well versus students who don't, and mm-hmm. how that becomes kind of an outing of, oh, you don't fit into this culture, but guess what? I also don't fit into that culture, yeah. so where does that leave
yeah.
me? Because, that's the question we're all asking.
And I think I just want to hit on how important language is, right? Mm-hmm. Because as a person who's taken Spanish but is American and white, it's a really cool thing that I speak a second language.
Yes.
And other people speak, like, their first language isn't English, but they speak another language like Spanish and English. Like,
they're looked down upon.
Yeah. And I'm looked at as, like, some superior form of intelligence. Mm-hmm. Let me tell you, I'm not. And I think about that a lot, and I've sat through a lot of classes where a lot of Latina people are saying, my parents don't want to teach me because it was safer. Mm-hmm. It was safer just to assimilate in yeah. as much as we could because we didn't want to stand out anymore. And yeah. I think that relates back to the work that we do with sexual violence, right? Because if you don't feel safe to report, if you don't have also the mm-hmm. language to report, mm-hmm. Or, like, the resources to help you, like, report to the proper people or the mm-hmm. people that you feel that you can trust and are safe, like, if the whole structure is against you.
Yeah, or if you don't feel safe going to get the necessary healthcare you need.
Yeah. And, like, A, you say you don't speak English and you show up to the hospital and there's nobody there who mm-hmm. speaks your language, and we'll keep it to Spanish. Like, yeah. there's nobody there who speaks Spanish.
Which I will say, though, if you are a survivor, I think Chanel mentioned this when she was on the podcast last time, but if you are a survivor and maybe you're undocumented, or you have, like, like a warrant for your arrest or something, you can still go and receive the services. It's not, the nurse will never report that. They're there to support the survivor. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to say that.
Yeah. No,
and it's not like another barrier. Like, mm-hmm. the sexual assault nurse examiners are there specifically to support survivors. Mm-hmm. That's what they're going to do.
Yeah. But I also think that is such a small community that knows that knowledge.
Yeah.
We know that knowledge because that's our
on
job.
Purpose.
Yeah.
Yes,
yeah,
yes, exactly.
Exactly. That barrier, that line is there to make sure that Latina people don't report it, mm-hmm. right? And if they do, then they worry about mm-hmm. if they are undocumented, if they are DACA. Yeah. Even, like, even Latina people who were born in America, mm-hmm. they face threats of deportation.
Yeah.
Even though America is their home country. When they go and report. And so it's really, like, designed to say to Latina identifying survivors, like, your story isn't going to be believed, even though we as an organization completely believe you mm-hmm. and know that your story is valid and happened to you. The yeah. system is designed. And so how do we rectify mm-hmm. that? Like, how do yeah. we look at the institutions, and how do we do prevention ed and say we recognize that Latina identifying people mm-hmm. face different barriers to yeah. healthcare, to yeah. resources, to proper language translation, to prevention in their native language, in their language that they feel most comfortable speaking in. But also recognizing that, like, not every Latina identifying person speaks Spanish mm-hmm. because for a lot of people that was considered safer.
Yeah.
So...
yeah, I think there's a lot to be said about everything that you just said. I'm trying not to lose my multiple train of thought. one of those would be just talking about those barriers that exist in mental health, too, which is an obvious tie to all of this, too. Even just there's a cultural barrier, right? Because I've liked to deny, as somebody who is studying psych and is interested in therapy, I like to deny that there is a difference between what your therapist identifies as versus you, and that doesn't make a difference. That is not true. It can make a very big difference, mm-hmm. and I think a lot of people of color who are finally accepting mental health are finally looking for those therapists who either know about those cultures mm-hmm. / identify as those mm-hmm. cultures, because I think that is super important. So there's a cultural barrier. There is a language barrier mm-hmm. as well. There's also, within the language barrier, that certain cultures that speak different languages identify their mental health issues in different ways yeah. because of the culture as yeah. well. So some will say more physical symptoms, but those mm-hmm. really obviously relate to mental as well. So I think there's a lot to be said about that. Also, if you look at just the statistics of domestic violence yeah. And how people of color are affected in a more statistical way than yeah. other groups of people, and how those are the people that need a lot of that care and, yeah, are just barred from it intentionally.
Become a Z-Center Survivor Superhero today. Superheroes are committed to ending sexual violence with ongoing gifts. Z-Center is committed to serving survivors through the pandemic and beyond. Your gift provides art therapy supplies, phone line access, self-care kits, and counseling to the resilient clients we serve. The Survivor Superhero Program ensures your participation in our daily mission with your monthly contribution. Your gifts have a lasting impact and make you a superhero our survivor clients need. Sign up at zcenter.org under the Donations tab.
I think I want to touch on imposter syndrome, because that's not something that I've talked about.
Oh, yeah. I mean, definitely, imposter syndrome. What are your thoughts on it? What were you thinking when you mentioned it?
Yeah, I think that it's something that when I, learned the term, I was like, oh my goodness, mm-hmm. this is what I've been feeling. This makes sense to me, finally. Which I think was so striking, but just so helpful to finally have words to attach to this big, intense, scary feeling. And I think that imposter syndrome has been on my mind so much recently, an annoying amount recently. Just thinking of being a senior and thinking of doing all these things in these clubs, but also thinking of I'm leaving these clubs soon. And what is going to happen after that? And that's okay. That's something I need to let go. And that I need to be okay with that. And just thinking that, you know, I'm where I am. And yeah, sometimes I'm like, wow, I did this. And sometimes I'm like, oh, but did I just somehow skate by? I think that's the classic imposter syndrome thoughts. And I think that's something that I've been struggling with a lot as a senior. And I've talked to other people about this. I've even talked to professors about it, which is kind of helpful and scary to know that they have these same thoughts. Mm-hmm. And one of my professors actually just recently told me that she tells herself, I can do hard things, before a tough meeting or before she's about to do something, to kind of just reinforce and kind of fight back to the imposter syndrome. And I kind of like that narrative of fighting back to it and finding, I don't know, a quote or a mantra or something mm-hmm. that can be helpful. So it's something I intend to do at some point, just haven't gotten to it. But yeah, I think that's a really big discussion, especially I think in students of color.
Yeah.
In the Latina community, I think this is something that we've also talked about. And probably would be a good thing to talk about further.
Yeah, I think not even just for students of color.
Mm-hmm. First-gen students too.
First-gen students, people identify as female or non-binary mm-hmm. or transgender, right? Because especially in academia, yeah. those spaces were created for cis straight white men. Mm-hmm. And so if you don't fit any of those identities, you're going to have some kernel of imposter syndrome.
Yeah,
and then the added intersectionalities of that just, I think, make that even more present in oneself. And so it's disrupting the norm within these spaces where you have to say to yourself, no, I do belong. Mm-hmm. I know what I'm doing.
Yeah.
And you're right, having a quote or something to just consistently remind yourself, I know I can do hard things. I know what I'm doing.
Yeah, and even that thought of yeah, you do belong here. I remember that. I've told students that, and that my teacher told me that before I even mm-hmm. went to college, and how important those words have been. But how you can say that to somebody else and still
mm-hmm.
sometimes not believe it for yourself, mm-hmm. I think is just a point of struggle too.
And I think you bring up a really good point about representation and the idea that, like, a lot of the spaces that we're trying to break into through activism and through being allies are spaces that we've never seen ourselves in, right? And, like, the representation of Latine people on the screen, in media, are only ever talked about in conversations about migration, conversations about over-sexuality, of the traditional Made in Manhattan with Jennifer Lopez, and this idea of the roles that Latina women can have. And I think that that can be a very big form of imposter syndrome, is when you've never seen somebody that looks like you or sounds like you or has a background like you in the spaces that you want to go to or the spaces that you're existing in. And then you look around and it's nobody who looks like you or very few people who look like you. Like, how are you supposed to rectify that in your brain?
Yeah, and that's something that I think I've thought a lot and have had discussions with my friends, because they talked about, like, I used to accept representation as, wow, they're finally talking about me, like, that looks like me. And then at some point I was like, no, but that's not true representation. Like, I'm not going to settle for just representation. I want true representation. Yeah. I mean, I think that's something that I'm starting to realize now. I mean, when you talk about some of those specific stereotypes, so being loud, being whatever, we can put a whole bunch of other words there, right? And that over-sexualization of Latina women. And dealing with that, and never, and then being told that I was loud my first semester by my friends, my white friends at school, was the first time that I ever dealt with that, and being, like, other, being known as the one who was the party one, like, or, like, getting the group together, like, being in charge of people, I think is something that I've recently started to think back on, and just think how weird that was for me to hear that and not experience that until I was in a room full of white people. Especially when these things are being said by your friends and people that you care about. And that you, and you just, like, accept it because they're people you care about. But then later you're like, ooh, I don't know, that didn't make me feel great.
Yeah, and they're taught to, like, ignore the harm, right? That it's not there. That, oh, if they're offended, like, then they're just sensitive, right? Like, it's not me. Like, so that our... your white friends don't have to do that internal, like, wait, that was fucked up, right? It's like a pass is given to them.
Yeah. And I think a lot about, because, like, as a person who also gets called loud a lot, that's not a stereotype that white women get. So the harm that it causes me is, like, self-esteem one. It doesn't have the connotation as it does with the stereotype of saying that a Latina-identifying woman is loud. And I think a lot about the quote, well-behaved women seldom make history, which is a completely misunderstood quote. Because what it's actually saying is that the people who do the regular things, the women that were doing the regular things, they never got written about. And I think that is a lot of where representation is lacking today. We see a lot of, like, middle-class, happy suburban white families, but we don't see Latina families or Latino families doing that. We don't see Black and African-American identifying families doing that. So, like, where's the middle ground that a majority of Latino people identify as?
Or you think of, like, having two working parents and having to, for instance, like, being the older sibling and take care of the younger siblings or things like that. We don't really see that, but that happens, especially when you need two working parents.
So I want to get to Red Love in Her Arms as well. Now that this isn't, like, a fantastic conversation, we can keep going, but I also want to make sure we're also touching upon that, right? Because September is Suicide Prevention Awareness Month, and I think this is, it's really important, right, that we also dedicate time to talk about mental health and the work that you are doing with this group on your campus. So I think we kind of touched upon it a little bit earlier. But you want to kind of just go a little bit deeper into what exactly is To Write Love in Her Arms, its mission, and how and why you got involved in it.
Yeah, of course. So To Write Love in Her Arms is actually, like, a national organization. So that's why I call the group on campus a chapter of that, because we get a lot of our resources from that national organization, so we don't always have to create it ourselves, which is actually really helpful. We have some kind of guide when it comes to talking about a lot of these topics. And at least the mission for it, in the way that I conceptualize it and we go about it on campus, is we advocate for mental health awareness and education, but we also like to put a self-expression spin on it. So whether that be through open mic nights, through just like drawing different prompts or writing about them, or coloring, or we like to do a lot of like hands-on themes too, to actually talk about how we feel and talk about these different issues. And you mentioned that it is suicide prevention month. So we recently like had a meeting where we got flyers from the actual Detroit Love and Heart Arms organization. And we, their prompt for this year, they have a different prompt for every year for Suicide Awareness Month. And that was Another Day With. So we put these flyers, we handed them out, and we had students write, "What do you want another day with?" And for some students, that made them think about things that they really enjoy and their most favorite things. And for some people, it made them think of, like, if this was their last day, like, what would they do, or things that they miss, or people that they can no longer be with that they would like to be with. So we heard kind of a whole host of different feelings and emotions that were brought up by this prompt. But I think it really also enforced us to think about things day by day, which when you think about mental health struggles, that is sometimes what you literally need to do to survive. So I think that is really important. And we put that up on campus so that people can write on it as they're walking by and kind of add their thoughts to what they want another day with, or who they want another day with, or et cetera. And I think that's kind of just one of the things that we do. We always talk about burnout, because it happens every semester, at least once a year. We talk about that all the time. We talk about healthy boundary setting, especially when we think of students going back home for vacations and for breaks, and how that might be hard for some students. We talk about like healthy relationships, and that's something we'll be talking about in October. And we kind of just also like go by what people want to talk about. So sometimes it changes per semester, whatever it comes up, what people are thinking about. We want to talk about, there's a lot of seniors, you want to talk about what it means in this time of like instability, like what do we do next? How does that feel? What are we doing now? We also, our next meeting is about the impact of COVID, which is still going on, right? And how does it feel to be back in person? Like that adjustment, like how are people dealing with that adjustment? Because it has been an adjustment, and plans that have fell through or completely changed. Like, how are we dealing with that now? Have we had a time to catch up and deal with it? Because I don't think we have, which will lead into burnout and different things like that.
Yeah, I think the most important aspect of this group, from what I'm hearing, right, and as it relates to Suicide Prevention Awareness Month, is that it exists, right? Because I think the biggest thing we can do for suicide prevention and awareness is talk about it and say, like, it's okay to not feel okay.
Yeah.
And if you are contemplating suicide, like, let's talk about that. How can we help you and support you, and what can we do?
Yeah, so that's actually something that brought up, that students want to hear, how do you have that conversation with someone who is suicidal or is having these thoughts? And that's something in the past where we've had health and wellness, so our institution's kind of like mental health resource office come and talk to students and actually improv it out. Like, if someone says this to you, how do you respond? What do you say? How do you best support them? How do you show them where the right resources are? And this is a goal of not only the club, but also something that we think is really important to like actually get up and do. And getting familiar with just saying these words that we're not familiar with, always talking about how we're feeling or helping somebody else and giving that support. And I think, again, that just relates to like different intersectionalities and different cultures who don't even have these discussions, or do but do in a very different way, or hardly do and are now trying to figure out how to have these conversations. So I think, yeah, I think it's important to think about just meeting people where they're at and having these just get up and just say it to somebody. And what do you say? And this is how you can best help them. And having somebody there to guide each other when our peers and our friends and our family are struggling, and ourselves.
Yeah, and if you're looking for a resource,
it's called QPR. I think we raised money one time for the Z Center for our open mic night. If I'm not mistaken.
Oh, did you? Well, this is someone, we had them come talk to our volunteers last night. They're from the Warren Township Family and Youth Services. And this woman, Becky, came to talk about their QPR training, which is a national suicide prevention training. QPR stands for Question, Persuade, mm-hmm. and Resources. Mm-hmm. And so if that's something you would be interested in learning more about and bringing to Detroit Love in Her Arms in your campus and like the resource center there, if they don't have it, I can, Cassidy, mm-hmm. we can send you her information. Because she last night, she was like, send me recommendations. Yeah. I want to train everyone on QPR. Yeah. Yeah, so that if definitely. They know someone, you've got this small little nugget of information yeah. of like, this is how I can handle this conversation. It's yeah. not that daunting. Exactly. I just need yeah. to have a conversation mm-hmm. with this person.
And I think it's so, like, bringing up this idea of like resources and conversations, mm-hmm. I think it's so important that like community organizations mm-hmm. like the center continually make our presence known mm-hmm. as resources for the community. Like, one of the things that we're doing is, like, we are sending out, like, schools are getting emails from me, like, once a week, where I'm like, hey, I'd love to come talk to your students.
Hey!
It's really just like, hey, I'd love to come talk to your students about sexual assault prevention. And I think that that's really important, that like, what you're doing and the work that you're doing is, like, just starting those conversations mm-hmm. and finding those mm-hmm. resources. And there are community organizations out there. But how do we continually make their presence known? How do we make them accessible? How do we make them community-driven and things that represent everybody?
Yeah.
One question.
Yeah.
We understand that fighting for Latine rights is a year-round thing yeah. and highlighting mm-hmm. Latine people is a year-round thing, and that's something that we're constantly working on. And so I was wondering if you could just talk really quick about Hispanic Heritage Month,
oh, yeah.
mm-hmm. what that means mm-hmm. to you, how you view it as a person
yeah.
whose identity is supposed to be celebrated in this month. So just a little bit about Hispanic Heritage Month, thoughts on us inviting you to talk during this month, anything like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I think it's really, yeah, it's definitely important to have this conversation. Oh, and something too, like as a club, we've been tackling, like, what do we do? So every year we have a Semana Latina, mm-hmm. And it depends on just when it falls. And mm-hmm. this week we're using this month mm-hmm. to say, well, here it is. It's already for us. Might as well mm-hmm. Do this sometime in October. But I think I've heard a lot of different thoughts from different people. And on one aspect of it, you can think of the marketing of it and companies yeah. using it, which they do this for Pride. They do mm-hmm. this all the time for different mm-hmm. things. And that never feels great. Again, it's that like representation but not true with mm-hmm. thought representation. Mm-hmm. So I think we see a lot of that going on right now. But I do think that it's important to think about how for Hispanic Heritage Month, it's about all of the different, it's also centered around different cultures, mm-hmm. Different countries' independence. And that's kind yeah. of why it's set at the time that it mm-hmm. begins and ends. Mm-hmm. So I think it's really important to think about how we are grouping all of these different countries' identities and cultures together
into one month.
Yes, exactly, into one month, and saying this is your month, and you're gonna celebrate it how you celebrate it, if you even feel comfortable celebrating mm-hmm. it, and etc. Right. So I think that it's important to have this space and to mm-hmm. have this visibility and to be able to do concrete, important things with it. Mm-hmm. But it can easily turn into just a marketing yeah. scheme of just, yeah. hey, this is your month, we're gonna sell you this product now, and things like yeah. that. So I think it's really important to thinking about it super intentionally mm-hmm. and what we're actually trying to do within these few weeks, within mm-hmm. this month, and who it's actually for.
Yeah.
So I think those are conversations that we're still having and yeah. still trying to find out. And then when you think about representation and different things like doing a panel, how do you pick who goes on the panel and mm-hmm. who can they speak for? They can only speak for themselves. And
yeah.
maybe they had concrete conversations with friends. Maybe they can talk about those conversations. Mm. But I think it's important not to get wrapped into representing a whole culture or even, you know, more than just one person in yeah. a few conversations. Yeah. It's something that I think is important to think about right now.
And then just a follow-up question on that, and then I'll be honest. What is your opinion on the use of the word Hispanic yeah, for Hispanic yeah. Heritage Month, right? Because mm-hmm. it's really supposed to be highlighting Latina mm-hmm. identities in countries in South America. And a lot of people are starting to really push back against the use yeah. of the word Hispanic as it relates to Spain, and Spain colonized
yeah.
and committed a mass genocide of indigenous mm-hmm. people throughout
yeah.
What is now known as South America. So I just was wondering, do you have any thoughts or opinions on the use of the word?
We talk about these different words and what we want to use and what we don't want to use all the time. Mm-hmm. So I think knowing the importance that there is a difference between what Hispanic means and what Latino means, mm-hmm. and knowing that one is based in, like, yeah, Latin American countries and one is based in Spain more, and that example, and also just knowing, like, Hispanic generally, like, there's just this weird feeling about that word, mm-hmm. and some people, like, I can't even explain it, but I know
it's
a lot
like
of
a negative
people,
connotation.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is. So a lot of people don't even like that word in general. Mm-hmm. Also just thinking about filling out different papers and having mm-hmm. to mark more than just what you are. Mm-hmm. And for some people, of course, that makes sense because they are of different cultures, so mm-hmm. they get to mark those, but yeah, I think that's a whole other discussion too.
Yeah.
But I think that it's important to know what these different words mean, mm-hmm. to know that different people want to use different words. Mm-hmm. We've had this conversation between Latinx and Latine and what people prefer and what sounds more natural and what doesn't sound more natural, because I think some people forget that they both originated within the culture, if you will, within the mm-hmm. American culture, mm-hmm. Of, like, I forget exactly from who, but they've originated within the culture, mm-hmm. but one sounds more foreign than the other. And that's a distinction that people like to use. But I think it's important to know what people prefer and what it actually means. Because mm-hmm. lumping these terms together, assuming that they mean the same thing, is completely mm-hmm. incorrect and just reflects how we get lumped together. Yeah. And there's no care or thought done to what is being said. Yeah. So I think those are conversations that we are actively always having and are important to think about.
Especially because language is always changing.
Yeah, and culture. As someone who studies communication and psychology, I think language is super important.
Definitely.
That was it for me.
You feeling good?
Yeah, I think so.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for coming in and agreeing to be on our podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Anytime. We always love continuing conversation. So if something comes up and you're like, we should talk about this,
thank you.
Thank you all for listening to this episode of 73 Seconds. For more information on how to support surviving your life, you can head on over to our website at zcenter.org. While there, be sure to learn more about how to become a survivor superhero. Join us in the fight to end sexual violence today.